So as I was just mentioning last week, we spent some time talking about Soloveitchik, Kol Dov Dido Feik, and his discussion of learning from the lessons of history. And after the shiur, I asked some of the people, I forget what the context was. Maybe we were talking about, Harold, you might remind me of how we got onto Japan and post-World War II. But we were talking about the fact of sometimes in history, history is always a portrayal, a subjective portrayal by the victors. And whoever wins, they get to kind of project their version of history. We're talking about how come the United States doesn't get blamed enough for what happened at Hiroshima. We don't hear about the world being upset at the U.S. for being the ones to drop the bomb. And we were discussing, you know, what the difference between the United States and Iran or any other country, and the response was because we won. We write our own version. And I thought it was really profound. It was the conversation we had after the class last week, which Rabbi Schachter actually deals with in this article. It was from part of the segment that I actually skipped, which is really the subjectivity of history to begin with. So I thought it might be interesting for us to take a look at the small packet over here, the four pages that I have here on the handout. It's page 208, just to get a... you know, just to get a perspective on our conversation last week before we jump back into the larger article. So this is a teaching from Professor Isidore Tursky. Does someone want to take it from the top of 208? Harold, go for it.
My late teacher, Professor Isidore Tursky, told me in the name of his teacher, Professor Harry Austrin Wolfson, that scholarship is not what you happen to know about a subject. Scholarship is what there is to know about the subject, about that subject. Yet, how many of us who toil in this vineyard can say with certainty that we have uncovered every cluster, plucked every grape, and maximized the yield of every vine? Have any of us indeed ever fulfilled Wolfson's dictum in all its intimidating detail? The British historian Edward H. Carr wrote, "The facts are really not at all like fish on a fishmonger's slab. They are like fish swimming about in a vast and sometimes inaccessible ocean, and what the historian catches will depend partly on chance, but mainly on what part of the ocean he chooses to fish in, and what tackle he chooses to use, these two factors being, of course, determined by the kind of fish he wants to catch. By and large, the historian will get the kind of facts he wants. History means interpretation." In his 1931 presidential address to the members of the American Historical Association, Carl L. Becker noted, "Left to themselves, the facts do not speak. Left to themselves, they do not exist, not really, since for all practical purposes, there is no fact until someone affirms it. However hard or cold they may be, historical facts are, after all, not material substances which, like bricks or scantlings, possess definite shape and clear, persistent outline. To set forth historical facts is not compatible to dumping a barrel of bricks. A brick retains its form and pressure wherever placed. But the form and substance of historical facts, having a negotiable existence only in literary discourse, vary with the words employed to convey them. Since history is not part of the external material world, but an imaginative reconstruction of vanished events, its form and substance are inseparable. It is thus not the undiscriminated fact, but the perceiving mind of the historian that speaks." In his presidential address before that same august body, only 2 years later, Charles Beard echoed similar sentiments. He stated that the historian, consciously or unconsciously, performs an act of faith. His conviction is a subjective decision, not a purely objective discovery.
So I think we already get the picture. I thought the imagery was very good of fishing, and that history in general as a subject has a subjective bend to it, and part of the struggle is what is historical truth, what is historical fact. You know, turning the page of 209 in the second arrow, he writes, "This is, of course, untrue. The facts speak only when the historian calls on them. It is he who decides to which facts to give the floor and in which order of the context." But while all this is certainly true, it's clear that the act of history writing places a premium on the search for the facts as they occur to the extent to which such a search is possible. So obviously history writers, in trying to attain a sense of objectivity, are looking for facts because facts are typically more objective. But the way they're presented is always going to add a subjective bend to it. On the next page, on 210, just highlighting some of the stuff, I don't want to read the whole thing now, he writes, while Pork makes the point that socialist societies in Eastern Europe have been particularly guilty of this egregious behavior, he notes that every society is somewhat guilty, the matter being usually one of degree. Again, throughout history, you have these boards and ethical board trying to figure out what is appropriate, what is considered the appropriate research to be a history book, but everyone to a certain extent is giving a subjective portrayal of the facts. So I just thought it was very interesting to see that the kind of the introduction to our discussion, which was, how do we present the Gedolim, how do we present the lives of our leaders, really this has a larger context as part of the greater conversation about the study of history as well. If you look on page 211, he gets into this in terms of the history of the state of Israel. So maybe, I don't know, Jerry, you want to read on the middle of 211 there?
The Jewish world is by no means exempt from such behavior, and the current raging debate over various events surrounding the founding of the state of Israel is a good example. In the late 1980s, Israeli historiography underwent a radical change with the emergence of a new school of historians who challenged the hitherto prevailing view of the founding and first few years of the new state. This group, led by Benny Morris, Avi Shalem, and Ilan Pape, contended that the old historians offered a simplistic and consciously pro-Israeli interpretation of the past, and generally avoided mention of anything that reflected poorly upon Israel. These new historians recognized that such deceitful and misleading descriptions may have been necessary in the early years of the state, when its future was not yet assured, and therefore blackening Israel's name would ultimately weaken Israel in its ongoing struggle for survival. Raison d'etat often took precedence over telling the truth. However, with a more recently achieved self-confidence, with newly declassified archives available now for the first time, and with the objectivity and impartiality of a new generation of scholars who matured in a more open, doubting, and self-critical Israel, an entirely different set of conclusions was now possible and appropriate. It was now argued, for example, that the Arab world did not fully devote itself to destroying the nation's Jewish state in May-June of 1948. The combined Arab force then was not overwhelmingly stronger than that of the Yishuv. The Palestinians did not leave their homes then voluntarily or in response to orders from Arab leaders. And finally, it is simply not true that at the end of the war, the Israelis wanted peace, only to be repeatedly rebuffed by their recalcitrant and intransigent neighbors. The ferocious counterattack.
I'm gonna ask you to skip down to the where the arrow is. As in this quote from Benny Morris,
I'd like to know who says all this stuff.
In terms of what?
I'd like to know who says these things that the Israelis didn't just want peace. The Arabs didn't flee their homes and so on.
Oh yeah, no, it is interesting to know where.
And that's the new historians.
I'd like to know who it is.
The Israeli historians. They mentioned some of them.
You're saying that footnote 58. Yeah, I don't have the footnotes here. Yeah.
In trying to produce or maintain an unblemished record, nations and political movements sometimes rewrite not only their history, but also, it appears, the documents upon which that historiography must necessarily be based. The Zionist movement and the State of Israel are no exceptions. Indeed, they may be among the more accomplished practitioners of this strange craft.
So I thought that's really, that's where we get into real murky waters. When not only can you tell your story, but when you doctor up, firsthand documents. And really, this was the introduction that Rabbi Schachter gave towards where he turns his interest onto the Orthodox community and the whole discussion of Uncle Tom's Cabin, as we spoke about my uncle the Netziv, and all the other changes, was in the context of acknowledging that history is has a subjective component to it, and noticing that it's not, we're not trying to say that only Orthodox Jews, only Art Scroll Feldheim, you know, you name whatever whitewashing you've seen does it, but this is a much broader issue. So I welcome you to read the whole five pages there in that little pamphlet, but I do want to use that really as a springboard to get back into our conversation, which is in the larger handout. Any comments on that first part, though? Anything jump out?
Yeah, the thing that jumps out is the next paragraph, which we didn't read, which is a brief pushback against the new Israeli historiography.
Mm-hmm.
there are plenty of scholars who lambaste these jokers for doing this, and I have to say I'm obviously among those.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean,
okay.
It's worthwhile.
Okay, so I want to get back to our conversation, and that really was on page 231. If you remember 2 weeks ago when we last spoke about this topic, Rabbi Schachter raised a really important point, which was that not only does one lose their credibility when they change the facts when it comes to a Maisa Rav, but more so than anything, what separates a Maisa Rav, let's say, from the episode of David and Bathsheba, or from history in general, is that a Maisa Rav or a Gadol's perspective on something is Torah itself. And the language he used, I thought was very profound on page 231, was second paragraph, in a real sense, to consider this entire matter as relevant merely to history is to trivialize it significantly. For indeed, distorting the words of a Gadol is not just distorting history, it is distorting Torah. A Maisa Rav of a Gadol bestows also Torah, not only is Chidushe Torah on Good Achas Mechitza, is not intentional distortion of the behavior of a gadol tantamount to rewriting a problematic tosos. Is it not gilei panim b'torah hagadol shelo kalacha, even if the distorter is absolutely convinced that his opinion is the real halacha? So I thought that was really an important point to why are we spending so much time on this? Why does it matter? Is it just, you know, Lakewood? Is it just our curiosity? Is it just that, you know, it's interesting to know that Lakewood, you know, revoked the book and sent this whole letter saying, "Es chatai maskir yom chatasti avisi b'shati." It is interesting, you know. There's something about it which grabs us. But I think what Rabbi Schachter is trying to say, and he says it over the next couple paragraphs. Again, I don't know how much inside reading you guys enjoy doing versus outside discussion, but really is the conversation of, this is Torah you are playing with, and really the part I really would like to pick up on is really the top of page 232. I think here he raises a, really says it sharply. Mike, you want to take it on top of page 232? In addition.
Hang on. In addition, does such behavior not betray an extraordinary sense of hubris? Are not all these later writers claiming that they know better than the Gaon of Vilna or Rav Hirsch or Rav Soloveitchik or Rav Zevin or Rav Bloch what appropriate Jewish behavior entails? Is it not a distortion of the Das Torah of Rav Zevin, for example, to omit those words of his about the state of Israel, or that of Rav Bloch to omit his letter about the state? Maybe they both wanted this information to be known. Perhaps the Gaon was happy with how Rav Baruch of Shklov described their conversation and would be upset with the current effort to deny it.
That was regarding his view on secular studies, being machshir of secular studies.
Maybe Rav Hirsch would be offended by what he would consider to be contemporary distortion of a position he held very dear.
And Rav Hirsch's conversation was about Torah Umada, whether Torah Umada was lechatzchila or shaset achak, kind of a horosh shah.
Indeed, what right does someone today have to come along and say that he knows better? In these circumstances, distorting the truth preserves the author's views of what he believes the Gadol should have been, and not what in fact he was. I am reminded of a quote by James Russell Lowell: "The mythic instinct ere long begins to shape things as they ought to have been, rather than as they were." But the problem is even deeper than a disrespect for authority. There is an essential inconsistency here. Again, mima nafshach.
Mima nafshach. Either way you look at it.
Mima nafshach.
If the distorter genuinely believes that the Gadol had erred on the fundamental issue of Hashkafa, then why admire him at all? Why consider him as an authority at all whose views need to be sanitized? Why does he not lose his status of Gadol entirely? If, for example, Rabbi Zevin or Rabbi Block erred with regard to Zionism, why should anyone care what they thought? And if they do remain authority figures, should not knowledge of what they really believed alter the very ideology the distorter is trying to protect? In a sense, then, does not the entire enterprise reflect a fundamental flaw? One invents a false position of a Gadol and then appeals to the authority of that very Gadol to uphold it.
Again, this is some serious stuff we're entering the realm of, and I think he raises some really profound way of lens of viewing these altars to history.
This is a very sharp criticism. I'd like to see how the people who composed that letter about the Netziv book respond to this. Do they just come back with the same, but it's not Das Torah, you can't say that? Which would just be ignoring the argument.
So what we're about to see in the next few pages is really, it's really in the bottom of this page, the next page, are really two very distinct ways of viewing this conversation. And again, this is what I like about Rabbi Schachter, is he really presents both sides of the discussion. We're about to see this letter of the Chazon Ish, which clearly says one thing, and the next page, Rabbi Shimon Schwab, seems to say the exact other opposite approach. So there is, I'd say, somewhere for the Lakewood position to hang their hat on. And that's part of the discussion, is that, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, or of some sort. So let's learn this piece of the Chazon Ish, which I think is just fascinating. The Chazon Ish, in part of a letter written, writes, Dati, ki ra'ui l'machzikim b'toras Hashem ladat. It's appropriate for those who uphold the Torah to know, egduya ba'ofim ha'amiti, the greatness in a real way, in a truthful way. Vim hutar ledaber lashon hara al uman bemunaso, la'ish adorish alech letzorach. If someone calls you and says, I want to hire someone for a job, and he calls you to ask about this, a character witness, can you give a testimony about this person? Is he fit to hire him? And you're allowed to relay what otherwise it would be considered lashon hara. Al misha torasso umnaso. When it comes to someone who is, his job is to learn Torah. Lo kol shekein shemutter lo dia lemachzikim b'torah. Isn't it not, even more so, should you be able to inform him if he's one of the ones who are trying to upkeep what is Torah? V'tzrichem ladat ki hayedia shel chachmei hador. Libam umidatam hen gufei Torah. Learning about the personas of a gadol b'Yisrael, that is learning Torah. Mikol makom tzarich lezeh zihirut yeteira upen mishana hadavar bikutzo v'nimsa moti shem ra or moti shem ra. Sorry, al tamer chacham. What Rav Chazon Ish seems to be saying almost explicitly is that if you're going to veer from telling the truth about a gadol b'Yisrael, so you totally, it seems to be saying you've lost what the olam needs to know. The olam needs to know what is this person's persona inside and outside, and by straying from the truth, you are presenting a false image of Torah. But you need to be careful. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Meaning, maybe we could say the Chazon Ish isn't. Maybe the Chazon Ish, you're right, isn't a pole in the sense. He's saying there needs to be tremendous weight given to what you're about to say, but he seems to give a green light for this learning about the Gedolim. This is it. This is Torah. So we need to know. That's what I took out of it. The fact that we need to know everything about them to learn from it.
More than just a green light, he's saying it's imperative.
Correct.
And that's that's what.
And that's what Rabbi Schachter is really trying to espouse. Let's call it the flip side. Turn the page. A number of years ago, Shimon Schwab writes, and this is from the selected writings. I actually looked at the quote because I thought I might have the book, but I couldn't find it. I know they have it in some of the local shuls. What ethical purpose is served by preserving a realistic historic picture? A totally different approach. Nothing but the satisfaction of curiosity. We should tell ourselves and our children the good memories of the good people, their unshakable faith, their staunch defense of tradition, their life of truth, their impeccable honesty, their boundless charity, and their great reverence for Torah and Torah sages. What is gained by pointing out their inadequacies and their contradictions? We want to be inspired by their example and learn from their experience. Rather than write the history of our forebears, every generation has to put a veil over the human failings of its elders and glorify all the rest which is great and beautiful. That means we have to do without a real history book. We can do without. We do not need realism. We need inspiration from our forefathers in order to pass it on to posterity. You wanted to know what Lakewood has to say. You just got your answer.
Which ignores the argument.
It is like totally hafuch of what we saw in the Chazon Ish or what Rabbi Schachter seems to be advocating for.
And what Rabbi Schachter says about that is, so then what value is it to anything you say? You just made up a fiction. That's great. Go read fiction. That's what he said 2 pages ago, and that applies here.
And I'm just putting the context. This is Rav Shimon Schwab. This is okay. Not me or you saying it.
Well, but what Rabbi Schwab is saying is that there's no value in truth. In other words, he's totally... Yeah. The only thing that's important is that we do something that's going to inspire our people. Well, what about the truth? Doesn't that have any value at all? And there's not.
Correct.
Why? Well, otherwise it becomes merely a satisfaction of curiosity.
Correct.
But that, I mean, how many people can live with that? I mean, one would think truth has a value in and of itself.
Correct. I mean, this is the argument that Rabbi Schachter's camp, let's say, or the camp I think that modern Orthodoxy probably espouses more to, is we're more inspired by hearing the factual truth. Right. Whereas there is a camp which believes that how you present something, there are different shades of truth.
Right. This is a very paternalistic view of how you get your information. I mean, there is a group out there...
Who needs to making decisions.
Who can decide what it is.
Correct.
That everybody else should know.
Correct.
And those that they pick and choose.
The censorship yeah. board.
That's Big Brother. It's the censored mind.
I don't know that that's exactly what's going on here. I don't know that that's what Rav Schwab is saying.
Okay, this is his follower over here.
You know, he may just be saying you don't need to know every bad thing a Gadol may have done. Let's say I was walking down the street and I saw the Gadol Hadorah walking into a porn shop. I don't know why he walked in there. Why are you pointing?
Because we're on camera. It's okay.
So what? Who cares?
You have to edit it.
I don't know how to do that. Okay, go ahead.
I don't care.
Go ahead.
You know? So what does that mean? We don't know why he went in there. Maybe he had to go to the men's room and there was nothing else around. You don't know.
Correct.
You don't know. So if you don't know that fact, what's the difference? What's the difference to what he said, to what he's telling people, to anything else? You don't need to know everything about everybody. That's what he's saying. You don't need to know the bad stuff in order to interpret the good stuff.
I like your comment. The where I push back is though, you're giving an example of something he did which can be interpreted in different ways. But what about when it comes to formulating our hashkafa on hot-button issues such as, is it okay to support Medinat Yisrael? Is it okay for women to learn? These are some of the examples that we didn't learn the examples, but these are the examples he talks about. Is Torah Umada a lechatchila, or was it a response to what was going on in Germany in the 19th century? So I agree with you when you see a person given the benefit of the doubt, but what about when a gadol makes a hashkafic statement and we put the veil over the statement? I mean, where do we draw the line of where we put the veil?
Or where there are inadequacies, or where there are contradictions, that are not subject to interpretation.
What's interesting is that the two examples, I think the classic example we started with, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and what we assume is a function of the newspaper and maybe depression from the Netziv, is that in both cases, different camps would look at it as a mark on their resume, and other people would view it as, you know, saying that something mundane is normal and okay. So again, I think there's, I agree with you just to Michael to a certain extent when it comes to the guy has, he picks his nose. Okay, I don't need to know that he picks his nose. What's it going to do for me either way? But when we're trying to hop on issues which are speak to the foundation of some of the hashkafic divides, wouldn't we want to know the truth? I think that's Rabbi Schachter's, what you're mentioning, yeah.
There may not be a truth. It may just be his position versus somebody else's position.
But in the world, again, Das Torah is a very complicated subject. But in our religious Weltanschauung, there's a concept of Das Torah. In that, again, my most basic way of understanding it is that through throwing oneself into the world of Torah and a lifetime of Torah, one has the ability to have a more objective way of tapping into the divine and articulating the divine. And so when it comes to what is Das Torah, it matters. It becomes well, what is God's? What does God want? And we look to our Gedolim to relate, convey to us what is God's wish for us. What you and I do on a Monday, I'll say what I do on a Monday afternoon doesn't matter. But when we're looking to our Yechidei school, we're talking about one in a century, you know, one in a generation, their hashkafic views, we hope, the concept is, are more tapped into a divine inspiration than your average person. Again, why do people go to the Rebbe? Why do they ask advice about the stock market and surgery to the Rebbe? Because their hope is there's a concept that the Rebbe is more in line, more sensitive to the frequency of God. That is the concept of Das Torah, from my understanding. And that was not a plug for you to come to me. I don't ask you. Go to your local doctors for your surgeries and your broker, your financial advisors for your stocks. But I want to go back to a point that Jerry raised, which was we're going to end in 5 minutes. But I want to go back to a point that Jerry raised, which is, I think the language you used was that it seems that Rabbi Schwab doesn't seem to care about truth. That was the statement. So I just wanted to clarify, because Rabbi Dessler, in a piece that in the bottom of this page, really speaks to that point and really sharpens this point a little bit. So first, let's just read Rabbi Schachter's kind of commentary. He writes, "How ironic is it that as we tell ourselves and our children about the life of truth and impeccable honesty of the good people, we need not be truthful and honest ourselves?" Which is, I think that was the reaction a lot of us had reading Rav Shimon Schwab. And then he quotes Rav Dessler. Right, two concluding thoughts. First is the most remarkable extraordinary essay of Rav Dessler, which radically redefines the nature of truth and which is directly relevant to this discussion. So someone want to take... This is actually from Michtam Eliyahu, Chelek Aleph. I read the piece inside today in Hebrew, but here's an English translation of it. So I want to take it. What is truth?
For him, truth has nothing to do with the reality of what was...
Where are you?
At the last...
Oh, okay, fine.
For him, for Rabbi Dessler, truth has nothing to do with the reality of what was or is. Truth, rather, is what is in keeping with God's will. He wrote, "What is truth and what is falsehood? At the beginning of our education, we were led to understand that truth is when one tells the facts as they occurred, and falsehood is when one deviates from this. However, this is so only in simple cases. But in reality, there are many circumstances when the matter is not so. Sometimes it is prohibited to relate things as they are, such as to tell something unpleasant to his friend without any purpose or need, and sometimes one must deliberately modify when the truth will not help, but damage. For then, what appears to be true is false, for it causes outcomes of evil, and that which appears as false brings to the ultimate truth. It would appear that truth is what brings to good and to fulfilling God's will, and falsehood is what grants success to the force of evil, the Sitra."
Just continue on the next page for one more paragraph. At the end of his brief essay.
At the end of this brief essay, Rabbi Dessler goes so far as to write that, quote, falsehood for the sake of such a truth, that is truth.
So what is the example that Rabbi Destro, I read the piece inside, that he tries to bring from a Torah perspective? The example he brings is Yaakov and Esav. He says, how could Yaakov Avinu have stolen the brachos? He used deception to steal the brachos from Esav and from his father. And Rabbi Destro, in a lengthy, Rabbi Schachter cut it out, but Rabbi Destro basically says that because Yaakov Avinu justifiably deserved the brachot, it was okay to trick his dad. And that's the example of Destro wants to bring, that Esav, who represents all the trickery and all the falsification of, you know, the Rashi tells us, Chazal tells us, that Esav would ask, how do you tithe this, and how do you do this mitzvah, and he would really, all this chicanery of trying to trick his dad and pull the wool over his eyes, he was the epitome of falsehood. And for Yaakov, the Ishtam, to get the brachos, that was okay, because it was all about the ultimate truth, which is God's will. I'm seeing some facial.
Two wrongs make a right. I mean, it's a tough one.
This is very self-serving of Rabbi Dessler, I have to say.
In what sense?
Because his opinion is implied, and he's twisting the words and twisting definitions in order to make it so. He's conflating the idea of truth and good. What is true is what conforms to is when your intellect, your judgment, conforms to what is. That's what truth is. Something can be false and good. Something can be true and good. But good is not the same as truth. But he's conflating them over here in order to make his point. I mean, it's not appropriate. They have to take this apart, parse this very carefully. But he's wording his statement in a very.
I want to stop with this point. I want to save the next piece for next week. So would you want to spend a minute on it?
Yeah, I'll say what. Look, he begins with a fallacy. At the beginning of our education, we were led to understand that truth is when one tells the facts as they occurred, and falsehood is when one deviates from this. That's not what truth is. Maybe we're educated that way, but then why is he bringing what a child is taught? Let's talk about what it really is. All right, so he's bringing that as if this is the definition of truth, and it's not. That's number one. And that sets it right off into a world of fantasy. However, this is so only in simple cases. But in reality, there are many circumstances where the matter is not so, where falsehood is not when one deviates from this.
Right, where you're able to tell white lies. And
that's what he's trying to justify. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's prohibited to relate things as they are. That's, again, not a matter of truth and falsehood. That's a matter of halacha, that is prohibited to relate things as they are. That's not saying what is and is not true. That's just saying when you can speak truth and when you may not speak truth. When you may speak a falsehood and when you should speak a falsehood and when you may not speak a falsehood. That's two different things. But he's conflating it. His whole argument is fraught with fallacy.
But again, I'm trying to better understand. Isn't that what's at the core of what we're talking about? When I can tell the truths of a gadol, or when I should put the veil over those truths, of what they actually said, what they factually said. He's trying to extrapolate
from
the laws of Lashon Hara to...
But he's saying here, and the way Rabbi Schachter introduced it, again, if the way Rabbi Schachter introduced it is mistaken, so we need to go back and read the entire piece by Rabbi Dessler, but the way he introduces it is truth rather is what is in keeping with God's will. That's how...
I mean, when I read Rabbi Dessler, I go back to what Jerry said as, who is this sensory board who makes the decisions?
Okay, I'm not saying that.
Who says what's God's will?
Fine. I'm saying truth is not the same as God's will. God's will is a will. It's an act of God's volition. Mm-hmm. And truth is what is. It's two different things.
I mean, I think he would argue.
According to Rabbi Schachter.
You, Rabbi Dessler, I think, would argue with you.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
He's saying truth becomes what's God's will.
But they're two separate concepts. Right, he does argue that. And that's my objection here. That's my strenuous objection. That he's conflating ideas that should not be conflated. Mm-hmm. We can understand, once we define what truth is, once we define what God's will is, once we define what good is, then we can see what the relationship is between those ideas. But to start at the beginning and say truth equals good equals God's will, they're different concepts. They're just different concepts.
You're saying because we have bad in the world, and that's also part of God's will.
Because we can
analyze the truth of these things, and I can tell, using my analysis, using my own thinking, mm-hmm. and yours also, that truth is what truth is. Truth is truth. It's not always good. And he's saying truth equals... Everything is the same in God. There's no definition in God. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the world of man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's my complaint.
Mm-hmm. Jerry, Michael, any thoughts? You asked me for what would Lakewood say. I mean, these are...
This is it.
Yeah. This is pretty clear from two respective Gedolim in the last century. You know, we don't have to call Lakewood. We don't have to look up who's the most yeshivish religious friend in Lakewood. This is black and white, what the perspective that they would respond to.
I have to think hard on that
one. About who you...
Yeshivish friend in Lakewood.
I'm sure you have a distant cousin, Lipschitz.
There's probably a couple of them there, but...
I'm just joking with you.
For him to go so far in the third paragraph, it would appear the truth is what brings to good and to fulfilling God's will, and then, in contrast, falsehood is what brings to the force of evil. That opens the door to making of the world exactly what you want to make of it.
And again, it goes back to the board.
Exactly
precisely what you're saying. The all-powerful censorship board.
Yeah. That's right.
You know,
that's right.
And I would venture to say there is black and white of good and wrong, that the whole halachic concept. But the problem is every example we've discussed is not halacha. We're talking about hashkafa. We're talking about a Gadol's view on state of Israel, a Gadol's view on secular knowledge. These are not black and white halachic questions. And there is someone who is basically coming along and saying, we don't want this Gadol to share an opinion which would seem to espouse that an ABC gray area that espouses one point of view. So we're going to hide that truth because we believe in a different truth than we want the world to know of or see.
Look, we had the mitzvah of and the procedure of sota, which serves to underline and emphasize how the Torah requires an honest relationship in a marriage, and go so far as to God will demonstrate what the nature of this marriage is, what the nature of what the truth is here, whether she was or was not Lizana,
mm-hmm.
and we had to stop it because people were corrupting it. We just have to stop it because husbands were being mizana, and that voids the entire process.
Mm-hmm.
So Moshe had to break the first luchos. You know, we have midrashim, that truth. You quoted the midrash. Truth is sent to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're left with mm-hmm. truth. We have ideological discussions, ideal discussions about what it should be and what it shouldn't be. But as a practical matter,
truth is what is.
We're left with a statistical blend of different positions. So now Rabbi Dessler's camp has ascendancy in Lakewood, and other camps have. You know, it's just a blend. That's mm-hmm. what we're left with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry.
Now the only other point I'd make is before we get too sanctimonious about it. Oh, look at what the right wing is doing in terms of. Go back to the first example about the historians, the new historians in Israel. Now, let's say I was a historian, and I'm looking through old documents, and I see, for example, Yitzhak Rabin's memoirs that he wrote about his years in the war, and in it he clearly says, oh yeah, we were told we had to drive the Arabs out of, and he lists like 10 villages, which is the true, you know, the new historians make a big deal about that. Like, hey, they didn't leave on their own, they were sent out because that's what Rabin was ordered to do. And he wrote it. So let's say I found that, and it wasn't known at that point. I might well have said, you know, I know this is the truth, I guess. He wrote it. At least it's true that he wrote it. But I might say, you know, but this is bad for Israel, and it, you know, doesn't reflect the overall necessity. Maybe I won't publish this. Maybe I won't bring this out, even if it's true. So based on our own outlooks on things, we might well be tempted to say, well, it's more important to be good than to be true.
Yeah.
You're right.
That's
In fact, that's what...
You're right, but if you leave it for somebody else to find, then you run the risk that it
could be worse, right?
And it all
you
does.
Say you gotta burn it.
You gotta burn it.
You gotta burn it.
You gotta burn it.
In the end, it all
if
comes
you feel,
out. Generally.
If you feel that way, you gotta burn it.
And what you're saying, kachava, in the sense that 30 years later, when Israel wasn't as on shaky ground, the new historians came along and said, we need to be more factual, or we need to bring these issues to light. It's interesting because the world of censorship is just not as effective anymore. There was a time where you look at Jewish Svarim, you look at Art Scroll and Feldheim, there just wasn't, I don't know, you compare the amount that's out there in print today, what's available to us, especially to an English only speaking crowd, it's day and night what's available to the masses today. So when we talk about censorship 40 years ago, we talk about, what year was that letter in Lakewood, 63? Was it, did I make that?
No,
80?
86, something.
Okay, but even in 86, it's a different world.
It began in the 80s. It began in the late 70s when there started to be a lot of English stuff. Art school began in the late 70s.
Correct, but I'm saying at that point, the censorship world could have some sense of control. I think today with the advent of the internet and website Failed Messiah and all these, you can find every dirt about every scandal out there about any Jewish person. It's public record on the internet. And the internet has changed the way that facts can be buried. And I wonder if, you know, what is the yeshivish world? Again, I'm not picking on them, but I'm just curious. In a world of censorship, how do you maintain that censorship in a world where everything is available with the press of a button?
By
censoring the internet.
Exactly. By censoring.
But does it work? But does it work?
It works to some degree.
For their people, it works.
There's always people who leave, who are on the outskirts.
Right,
but for the core, there's a core.
They don't. Well, they told not to look at the internet. They don't.
Yeah. I my understanding, I forget if it was Dr. Blumenthal, I think Dr. Blumenthal shared this in a community lecture for OHEL recently. He was talking about how the yeshivish community was incredibly successful with the advent of the television to Aser television, and it worked. And I might be misquoting, but I think Dr. Blumenthal said it was a testament to the Haredi world. They were able to raise a generation of normal human beings that did not grow up with TV. And the fact that their balabatim are just as normal as anyone else is a testament that they were able to control this TV issue, and they had a generation of normal, healthy balabatim. And what Dr. Muntal pointed out was that with the internet, initially, and still in certain camps, the Haredi world's response was exactly like the TV. Aser it. But the internet became too relied upon in business and everyday living, banking, email. I mean, it just became impossible to use the same template they used with TV, which was, you know, an outright ban. It just did not work with the internet. And then the problem becomes, now what?
Well, and also for learning. I mean, probably Chabad in particular, but a lot of them, you can learn on the internet. It's very powerful.
Correct. But you have these asifas, these famous asifas of the anti-internet gatherings that met, what is it, at the Shea Stadium, whatever, the new City Field, they have this thing, but it doesn't, it just, the internet became, my impression is that every Haredi household has the internet. Not every, that's a wrong. Most Haredi families have a computer with the internet. Yet there are ways of how do you have it. But my understanding, this is Dr. Muntal says also, that you need it for work. You cannot not have an email address. You cannot not be able to do online baking. There's certain fundamentals.
How would I know if a shiur is canceled?
How would you know to come to shul for Monday night when shiur is canceled? I mean, my understanding is that
don't come. There's a snowstorm.
My understanding is that the censorship of internet did not take on like it did for the TV. And therefore raises the whole censorship. What power does the censorship board have today?
What are we trying to censor? What are they trying to censor? The original, as I recall, my impression maybe, was just that the internet was equated to pornography. It made access to pornography so much easier, so ready at hand, they just said, just keep away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things that the Haredim are trying to censor. There are other things that we would consider censoring.
Mm-hmm.
Attitudes attitudes about life, not just pornography, but how do people dress in a commonly,
sure.
And not just dress, but how do
or
people
opinions, how do we think, how do we everything?
I'm saying that's where I'm going with that. So yeah. There's a lot more that's at stake with the ubiquity of the internet. There's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. It started very narrow, but
100%.
Much more. It's much more. There's just much more at stake now.
You inspired a thought that I just wanted to share before I forget it. One of the major issues or realities that the internet has now introduced to our society is that every single Joe has a voice. I mean, that is the idea of the internet. The internet is blogs and comments on every single person in the world has an authoritative voice. And I think when it comes back to our discussion, to put the to wrap up the context of our discussion of why does it matter what the Gadol says, is because we live in a world where every Joe Schmo has an authoritative position on everything. And therefore, if we're trying to figure out or filter or decipher for ourselves, well, what is God's will or what am I supposed to do with my life? It's critical in today's world specifically where everyone has a voice, to try to at least be able to tap into the Gdol Yisrael, let's say, whose voices all of us agree matter. You know.
When you say tap in, do you mean filter out the other voices? Or do you mean be able to have access to it?
Just have access to it. I want to know whether Soloveitchik or Rav Bloch or Rav Dessler, whoever in the Netziv, because I'm hearing this cacophony of voices out there to the point that if I want to know what does God want from me? I want to know what's the pristine voice of the Gadol. I think it's specifically the response to today's society, which, in that context, the world of this conversation is so apropos.
You want a voice that you can respect.
Correct.
And you do need to find a Rav who you feel speaks for you. I mean, this is what Aseh L'Charav means.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to find somebody who you feel you can speak.
Right, you don't want to find the smartest Rav. You want to find a Rav whose hashkafa coincides with yours, or at least that you...
Or at least you can aspire to it.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
You don't feel like you're estranged from it.
Right, that's very important.
But now that there's...
New website, Shop a Rav.
Shop a Rav?
That's good.
Shop a Rav.
But now that there's all these different opinions available, so...
Whose opinion is authoritative?
Well, Rabbi Schwab and Rabbi Dessler would say you have to be told who to regard, and
mm-hmm.
it's just as you say.
Trust
us. Whose opinion is worth hearing, and whose opinion you shouldn't hear?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can hear everybody, but you shouldn't hear everybody. You should only hear the proper ones.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to what Jerry was saying of like kind of what we're guilty of it also, to me, that doesn't sound so outlandish today.
That's what they're saying.
In a world of everyone has a voice, I don't care what the whole world is. I want to know what are my gedolim say. What are the people I look up to say?
I forget which one of the. What, it wasn't a crazy right wing girls' seminary, but a girl who went there. This is maybe 10 years ago. She was told by her rebbeim there, okay, you're coming back and you're going to go to Stern. Don't take, I think it was Saul Berman's class. We've heard he's very, So they were telling her. There are certain rabbis. You don't want to hear what they say. You don't
mm-hmm.
want to hear their opinion.
They're filtering which rabbanim are.
The same thing. I mean, you have to, we're telling you whose opinions you should even hear.
Mm-hmm. And that's this conversation. Yeah. Okay, gentlemen, I appreciate you coming out, and we'll pick up the conversation next week.